This is Jim Inkster coming today on Talk Louisiana. We will visit with GOP political consultant Scott Wilfong and Democratic blogger Lamar White of Bayou Brief. They will share views on President Trump on day 230 of the Trump administration, as well as DACA and the president's decision on that front. And as we look at the conflict with North Korea and the 2019 Louisiana governor's race with Scott Wilfong and Lamar White. Julian Guthrie will discuss her book, How to Make a Spaceship. Guthrie reports on a band of renegades, an epic race, and the birth of a private space flight as she details the remarkable odyssey of Peter Diomedes. And also, we'll have the latest on what's happening with Hurricane Irma as it appearing to churn toward Florida later this week. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us today for Talk Louisiana. Hurricane Irma passed over the island of St. Martin this morning as Floridians prepare for the worst ahead of the storm. As of 7 o'clock our time, the monster Category 5 storm's eyewall was butting up against Antigua with sustained winds of 185 miles per hour, even higher gusts. And going forward, the hurricane is forecast to move north of Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands this afternoon, unleashing strong winds, heavy rain, but not directly hitting the islands. By Sunday morning, Irma will be approaching mainland Florida and the Florida Keys. And we will keep you posted as this storm brews prolifically in the waters off the coast of the United States. And hopefully Louisiana will be spared the worst, as will the great state of Florida. 877-217-5757 is your number. 297-5633 in Baton Rouge, and the email is talk@talklouisiana.org. We're joined by Scott Wilfong, the longtime GOP political consultant, and Lamar White, a Democrat, a blogger from the left, and you can find out more about him at Bayou Brief. And we're talking about a few different matters, and if you'd like to join the conversation again, your number wherever you are, 877-217-5757. The Trump administration yesterday formally announced the end of DACA, a program that had protected nearly 800,000 young undocumented immigrants brought to the U.S. as children from deportation. The U.S. Department of Homeland Security will stop processing any new applications for the program as of yesterday and rescinded the Obama administration policy for deferred action for childhood arrivals. Attorney General Jeff Sessions says, "I'm here today to announce that the program known as DACA that was effectuated under the Obama administration is being rescinded." Your thoughts, Scott Wilfong, on this move by the Trump administration on what was day 229 of Donald Trump as president of the United States?
Well, I guess it's about time is my initial reaction. You know, that was something I had hoped that Trump would address earlier, but I understand why he waited. You know, I think it's a perfect political opportunity for him. It shines a light and reminds people about how Obama operated. He decided which laws he didn't want to enforce, and he didn't enforce them. If he couldn't get a law passed, he just made one up. And that's what we had for 8 years. And I think Trump it gives him an opportunity to kind of rise up and say, you know, I respect the laws of this land, and this is not a law. This is just simply one president's decision, and I'm going to change it.
Lamar White, my guess is that you see it somewhat differently.
Yeah, I completely, totally disagree. This is, you know, first of all, the president has prosecutorial discretion, and I think that the courts would probably agree with him, and they have agreed with him, that it was constitutional. We're talking about 800,000 people, young people, 100% of whom have no criminal record, 91% of whom have a job. These are Americans that were brought here by their parents when they were small children. So I think it's cruel and unnecessary.
Wait, how are they Americans if they were brought here illegally? That doesn't make them an American citizen.
Sure it does. They go to our schools. They've been here. The average dreamer was here at the age of six. English is probably the only language they know. How are they not an American?
If you think
by circumstance of their birth?
You're saying speaking English and driving cars and going to school makes you a citizen of the United States?
I'm saying that participating in everyday life here in America qualifies you as an American.
Well, the administration announced a plan to continue renewing permits for anyone whose status expires in the next 6 months, giving Congress Time to act before any currently protected individuals lose their ability to work, study, and live without fear in the U.S. So in essence, Congress is going to play a big factor in this, Scott Wilfong. I'm sure some members of the U.S. House are not pleased about this. Others probably are. But what do you make of this move by the Trump administration? Is he kicking the can down the road?
No, I think he's shining a light on the failure, honestly, I'll even say, of both parties for the last 25 years. Bill Clinton stood before Congress and talked about immigration was one of the greatest problems facing America today. That was 1993, I believe, 1994. Nobody's done anything about it. When Obama had an opportunity, when he had control of both houses of Congress, 60 votes in the Senate and the White House and the House, he chose to give us this disaster known as Obamacare instead of fixing illegal immigration when he had the chance, and then decided, well, I'll just use a stroke of a pen and get it my way. Well, it doesn't work that way. And that's why Americans rejected the Democrat Party and said, we are tired of this. And we put Donald Trump, the host of The Apprentice, is now president of the United States, folks, in case you haven't noticed.
All right. I think we have noticed that. This move sets a clock for Congress to act to preserve the program's protections under the DACA before the DACA recipients begin losing their status, which would be March 5th of 2018. And in a statement, House Speaker Paul Ryan reiterated his aspiration that Congress will reach a solution in time. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell praised the president's move. As we know, the Majority Leader and the president have not been on the same page, apparently not even speaking to one another. But on this front, Lamar White, it appears that the Republicans are largely united. So does that mean that the president gets what he wishes?
I don't know. I mean, I heard last night that he says that if he doesn't get what he wishes, that he may revisit the idea of just rescinding it altogether. So it shows that he's already wavering on this issue. You know, like Scott just said, I mean, I think it's actually been about 16 years since they tried to pass the DREAM Act. So, you know, we haven't been able to do it in 16 years. I don't know if there's a greater chance that it's going to get done today, but I certainly know that there's a lot of outrage all across America over this.
Well, in Louisiana, it appears that whatever the president proposes, he's going to get support from the congressional delegation with one exception, and that one exception is, of course, Cedric Richmond, the congressman from New Orleans, the lone Democrat in the delegation. But the two U.S. senators, Bill Cassidy, John Kennedy, they are in the president's corner every step of the way, as are the congressmen, all six of them. And when we look at this, Scott Wilfong, it appears five of the six of them. And that with those, of course, if you're keeping score, Scalise, who's sidelined right now after being shot. Also, Mike Johnson, Ralph Abraham, Clay Higgins, and Garrett Graves. Will there be any surprises on the Louisiana front, Scott?
No. These guys are solid. I mean, I've met with all of them. They understand the importance of playing as a team. I mean, this is, you know, that's the way it operates in Congress. And not only that, but, you know, there was this idea that these, the Jeff Flakes and the John McCains and these types were going to stand up to the president. And, you know, they may get their 15 minutes of fame, but in the end, he's still the president, and nobody really wants – in case you haven't noticed, they have to run again. At least the House has to run again next year. Trump's got till 2020, so he's got time on his side, and not that any of our guys would take him on like that because they're true conservatives. So, but I think nationally you're going to see less and less as these guys start having to run party primaries beginning next year. They're going to come back home to the party platform a lot more in large numbers, I think.
Well, if Congress does not act and DACA begins to expire, nearly 300,000 people could begin to lose their status next year, and more than 320,000 from January to August of 2019. Will this be an issue next year when congressional elections are held? Lamar White, what do you think?
I think certainly it will be in states like Texas and California, border states, Arizona, New Mexico. You know, in Louisiana, we have got about 2,300 people who have DACA status, so it probably won't be a hot-button issue in Louisiana as much as it will be in Texas. But, I think that it will be a national issue, but particularly in those border states.
Well, you know what status most Americans are concerned about is their employment status. It's just really hard, I think, for conservatives to get all worked up about an illegal immigrant, regardless of how they got here, losing their status or whatever it is. I think Trump is doing exactly the right thing. He's winding this thing down. If Congress wants to make a law, go for it. Otherwise, he's got jobs to create. He's got an economy to improve, which, by the way, if you haven't noticed, things are looking pretty good. So
you're giving him credit.
I don't think it's, it's happened under his watch. I mean, sure, the market was starting to come up as he came into office, but it's continued to rise. It continued to go up ever since January. Well,
the economy under the last president was good for the most part, wasn't it, Lamar?
Yeah, so I think there were 75 consecutive months of job growth. I think that if you were to draw a line from the day that Obama took office, or maybe a couple of months after he took office, after the recession, we started to recover, you'll see a straight line up. And I don't think Trump gets credit for the first 7 months of the economy at all, nor does he get credit for the stock market. That's kind of absurd.
Well, I was going to say, if you notice, the change actually happened on November 8th last year or whatever, the day after the election last year is when things started turning for the market. So I give Trump credit.
Stock market almost crashed that day.
Well, and then it came right back, and by Thanksgiving, mm-hmm. it was roaring. So I think mm-hmm. it was people realizing what was coming.
It's done well under this president, and it did well under the previous president. The Dow Jones Industrial Average from its low under President Obama tripled in his 8 years. So that means in order for President Trump to keep pace, it will have to be at 60,000, the Dow will, when he leaves office in January of 2025. Think about that. We're not even 8 months into this presidency. So if Donald Trump serves one term, there are more than 40 months to go. And if he serves two terms, there's a whole lot more time than that. There are about 136 months to go.
Wow.
We're back after this time out on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us. Ali Baltazar is producing, and your number for Talk Louisiana is 877-217-5757, locally 297-5633. You can email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Scott Wilfong on the right, Lamar White on the left. We're talking about President Trump, and I gave him a few too many months. If he were to be elected to a second term, the president would have 88 months to go. So eight down, almost eight down.
I like the 136 better.
Well, we would have to change the Constitution. I don't think we're quite ready to
maybe
do that.
Maybe with Pence. If Trump can do 8 years and then we can get eight more with Pence, then we could get to that 136 months.
Well, there are those, Scott Wilfong, who believe the president won't last his one term, that he'll either resign or be forced out of office. Your thoughts about that prospect?
Sure doesn't look like it to me. Looks like he's being the commander in chief and running the show. Unless he gets bored with it. I think if he stayed on the air with The Apprentice for almost 10 years, I think he can handle 4 or 8 years as president.
Little different environment than being on The Apprentice. But Lamar White, this president is under serious investigation by special counsel. It appears each day there's a new wrinkle in the Russian connection with his campaign. Is that going anywhere, or is this just a ripple on the pond?
It sure looks like it's going somewhere. You've got the special counsel partnering up with the Attorney General of New York for state charges. Like you said, every day there's a trickle. And, I think where there's smoke, there's fire. I think that he's obviously building a series of probably pretty compelling cases. So I think we'll probably see pretty quickly what's going to happen.
And, Scott, do you think the president is a victim of a witch hunt, or is this a legitimate investigation?
I mean, it's legitimate in that it's being handled, at least, I think, properly and the way it should be. But, in the end, what is the end game? What are they hoping to do? I mean, get an indictment? I would think he's certainly shielded from anything like that while he's president. I mean, the only thing that – and I'm not implying there's any – I don't think there was anything, any wrongdoing at all, but – it just seems like it's just a total waste. And from a political standpoint, if you don't like Trump, the liberals, do you really want Mike Pence as president? Is that your goal? Is that where you want to go with it?
When Bill Clinton was under siege, Al Gore would have been the president, but yet Ken Starr was pursuing this vigorously, and the Republican Congress, for the most part, was cheering him on. Scott, is this any different?
Well, no, I think it's you're just trying to score political points. I mean, the difference with the Clinton thing, what was unusual about that, the worst part of it was he was second term, so there was no reelection to worry about. All this was – the impeachment happened in 98 after he'd already been reelected. I think what you're seeing with the Democrats in Congress is they're looking at this as an election opportunity. for 2020 as a way to potentially beat Trump. I think that's what all this is, what I see it as.
All right. Well, I mentioned it earlier with Scott, but it appears, Lamar, the delegation is solidly behind our president, and I don't know of one major bill in which any member of the U.S. House from Louisiana, a Republican, or any of the two U.S. senators, Kennedy or Cassidy, have gone against the president. They have supported him essentially 100% of the time.
Yeah, and thanks for pointing that out. I mean, it's worth noting, Scott claims that this is, you know, Democrats engineering this investigation, that Congress is controlled by Republicans, and the committees that are investigating the president are controlled by Republicans. So it's a little specious to suggest that Democrats have orchestrated this investigation when actually the investigations are being, orchestrated by people in his own party. And some of the most, sort of vicious criticism against him and the collusion that he and his campaign may have had with Russia has come from Republicans. So I don't think this is an election year issue at all. This is about the integrity of our democratic process.
Well, what you're seeing when we talk about the vote, the way these congressmen are voting and how they're lining up with Trump, the reason, there's a very practical reason why that's happening, is because when they come back, they just had their August recess, and they go to their town hall meetings. I can promise you, I've been there. I know these folks. They're not hearing from their constituents, oh, please find out more about Russia. Please do more to investigate Russia. They're hearing about jobs, about health care, about things that affect real Americans. Guess what? Middle America, coast to coast, they don't give a rip about Russia. It's CNN. It's Chuck Schumer. It's the rabid liberal wackos in Congress that want to keep this churning.
You sound a lot like Hillary Clinton when she talked about a
vast
right-wing
conspiracy.
It's a conspiracy.
Vast left-wing
conspiracy. Which is more relevant, Vladimir Putin and Trump's connection to him, or Monica Lewinsky and Bill Clinton's connection to her?
Is that a play on words? Bill Clinton's never mind. I won't go there. I think the Clinton thing. We don't need to rehash that. But that was about perjury. That was about lying under oath.
Well, you've got Jeff Sessions who lied under oath when he was questioned about being Attorney General. He lied under oath.
I don't think that was a lie. I think he explained that.
It was an untruth.
It was an answer to a question that he thought went another way. I'm not going to speak for Jeff Sessions.
All right. But you like Jeff Sessions, don't
you? I like him being Attorney General. I think Trump had to put him in his place a month or two back.
Well, what about Jared Kushner, who filled out all these forms saying that he had no connections to the Russians, and it turns out he had a lot of them.
And we have a process going on that will reach a conclusion, and that's due process. That's how we operate in America.
Okay, so you're applauding the investigation
absolutely.
Of Robert Mueller.
Absolutely.
Okay, well, that's good. 877-217-5757 is your number, 297-5633. Lamar White, Bayou Brief is where you find him. We'll talk about what's going on in our state. Oh, by the way, we're 2 years away from what at that time in 2019 will be a hot and heavy gubernatorial election. But before we get there, this conflict with North Korea is continuing in a big way. Scott Wilfong, is the president handling this adroitly?
I don't know that anybody can handle this. I mean, you have an absolute insane person running this country, and now he might have a hydrogen bomb. Yeah, I think what history has shown that dictators like this don't respond well to force, and I think Trump is sounding tough. He's talking tough. You cannot show weakness with these guys. The best thing about the whole situation is I have even much more confidence in the generals that Trump has in place, even so than Trump himself. He has the best of the best in there. So I'm trusting that he's getting the best advice. And I don't know who could handle the situation.
Lamar?
I actually agree. I definitely have way more trust in the generals than I have in Donald Trump's ability to be the commander-in-chief. But I also agree it is a little terrifying. This guy is a bad actor. He's a sort of a loose cannon. I'm talking about Kim Jong-un. And, I really hope that we don't escalate this into war. It could be nuclear war, which is terrifying.
Yeah, that would be something that would be devastating on all fronts. But the president has the authority as commander-in-chief to launch a nuclear attack if he deems necessary, he or she, and in this case the president, until further notice, is Donald John Trump. Does he have the measured approach that most presidents have in this kind of an event, or is there concern that a man who tweets at 3 in the morning about matters that are largely insignificant might be a loose cannon? Is that a concern of yours, Lamar White?
Absolutely. I think it's a concern. It should be a concern of every American that this is a guy that watches cable news practically all day long and tweets at Fox and Friends in the morning. And so it is a little bit difficult to take him seriously sometimes on matters of foreign policy and you know, domestic policy. But particularly when you're dealing with an issue like nuclear war, and he tweets out stuff about, you know, what was it, fury and fire a few weeks ago, that just end up escalating things and make things worse.
Well, regardless of that, if the election had gone the other way, you'd have had the mastermind of the Benghazi operation sitting in the Oval Office right now. And I certainly feel a whole lot better with Donald Trump there than Hillary. So
you do. You think she would be a loose cannon?
I mean, we don't need to rehash all that, but I mean, she left 4 Americans to die in Benghazi. I don't feel real confident she'd have been looking out for me and my family.
Now, that's the way you portray it, but some would say it's a far more complex matter.
Well, to use her words, what difference does it make, right? What difference does it make?
Well, I recall more than 200 Americans dying in Lebanon when Ronald Reagan was president in 1983. But
different set of circumstances.
Well, okay.
Very different.
877-217-5757 is your number. We're back after the news with Karen Henderson with more from Scott Wilfong and Lamar White. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us. Sally Baltazar is producing, and your number is 877-217-5757. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Scott Wilfong and Lamar White on different sides of the political spectrum. Scott, a longtime GOP consultant in Louisiana, and Lamar White, a prominent blogger recognized nationally for his work, and Bayou Brief is his new endeavor. 877-217-5757. Hurricane Irma threw its first 185-mile-per-hour punch at land early today on the islands of Barbuda and Antigua, and was headed for the Virgin Islands and then toward Puerto Rico, according to the National Hurricane Center. The storm is the most powerful recorded hurricane ever in the Atlantic, driving north-northwest at about 16 miles per hour. A computer model shows that tropical storm force winds, which now go out to 175 miles from the eye, will begin buffeting Florida on Saturday morning. 297-5633, your local number, and as noted a few moments ago, in 2 years we'll know who's running for governor, and the race will be hot and heavy and already in full bloom. There may already have been a debate or two by September 6th of 2019. Governor John Bel Edwards is running for re-election. And Scott Wilfong, who's the most likely Republican to challenge him?
I think it's John Kennedy. I think he's the best positioned. I think there's no question he wants to do it. You know, he's every indication is he's focused more on state issues. He's inserting himself into the discussions on everything all the way down to local Baton Rouge issues here. So I think he's the odds on favorite to be that person. And he gets the plum that David Vitter had when he ran, which is if he wins, he gets to appoint his successor to the U.S. Senate. So that's a big, big advantage in keeping other people out of the race.
877-217-5757. Before we go to the phone lines, Lamar White, how would you envision a Kennedy versus Edwards race for governor?
It's an Edwards victory. I mean, John, you know, if John Kennedy wanted to be governor, I don't understand why. He just runs for office all the time. It's just another seat, another year. And I think that when Mary Landrieu and John Kennedy ran against one another, I think that John Bel Edwards would be wise to pick a page out of that playbook and just run with the Kennedy for whatever slogan, because I think that resonated with a lot of people.
William in Opelousas. Good morning, William. You're on Talk Louisiana with Lamar White and Scott Wilfong. Hi, William.
Hey, hi. How you doing?
Fine.
Yeah, I want to say this, that about the Dreamers. We have a law in this nation that anyone born overseas, if they got a parent that's an American citizen, they become American citizens. And their children that's being adopted from Russia, all these different places, and they can become American citizens. We have all these kids that have been brought here, and they're not American citizens because our Congress haven't made a law for them to become American citizens. But they're still Americans. And
all right. Thank you, William. Scott, what's your response?
Well, I'm not following you. Sure, yeah, if a child's born to an American overseas, they can have citizenship, but that's not what these so-called dreamers are. These are children of illegal immigrants who broke the law and came
saying,
to this.
He's saying Congress should change this, though.
Well, but he's equating a child born to an American parent overseas with someone that was brought here illegally.
That's the question, where do you draw the line? And a lot of these people who've lived here, they certainly contribute to the economy.
You draw the line the same way you drew it at Ellis Island
back
in the 30s.
Look outside the window here at Walmart, at Home Depot, rather. You see a lot of people who are waiting to work, and it's a case in which they do contribute to the economy, and Republicans and Democrats often like the cheap labor.
I just think that's the most, and I don't throw this word around very often, but that's the most racist and bigoted argument, that because they can fix my toilet or roof my house, that somehow they have value.
Well,
I think what makes Americans value is the
standing in line to do those jobs, Scott. Are Americans standing in line to do those?
I mean, I think people inherently have more worth than just simply what they can do with their
hands.
Some
of them do more than that. They do.
And we have a process.
Well.
We have a process where they can get in line and become an American citizen and enjoy the benefits of citizenship. I just don't see how that argument flies with they can do some work, so let them stay here.
Lamar?
It's just really hard to take. I mean, I know this is a difficult argument for Scott to try to make. And it's just hard to take anybody seriously who does make an argument that these people are somehow worthy of deportation. I mean, again, these are children who did not ask to come to America. They were brought to America, and there's 800,000 of them. That'd be like emptying out the entire metro Baton Rouge area. Can you imagine that? We're talking about deporting 800,000 young people. It's just cruel and offensive, and it's hard to take anyone seriously. I would assume that Scott agrees with the pardon of Joe Arpaio, right?
Yes, I certainly do agree with the pardon of Joe Arpaio.
You know, on the one hand, you've got a guy that's violating the Constitution, has been indicted and found guilty by a court of
violating
the law.
But who is an American citizen, though?
All right.
Who violated other Americans' constitutional rights.
Let's get to a few more people. 877-217-5757 for Lamar and Scott. Mike and Plaquemine. Good morning, Mike. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Good morning. All I hear is Donald Trump talking about how he got such a big heart. But all I see is heartlessness coming out of this guy. But if they can get those people out of here, if they was able to lock up a million black men with mass incarceration, they can get those people out of here. Please believe me. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, sir. Scott in Opelousas. Scott, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Yes, Jim, how you doing? Great conversation, as always. And compliments to WRKF. Just a question, putting it out there. You know, it sounds good, get them out, it's illegal. And they were, it did come illegal, I understand that. How much money are we willing to invest, or should we invest, in getting kids born to illegal aliens, along with their families, out of the state of Louisiana? And I think one misconception and pre-misconception that we're putting it out there, that everybody who is illegal is from south of the border, Mexico. Native Americans, there's a lot of Asians, a lot of Middle Easterners. That's everybody. So how much money are we willing to put down to get them out? Thank you very much.
Yeah, I'll just go back, and though we need to stay on the point of what the announcement was. Trump said, and Jeff Sessions announced, they are not going to enforce a law that Obama – it's not even a law. It's just simply an executive order, and he's putting it back on Congress. I don't think anyone, including Trump, if you remember through the campaign, he kind of broke with some of the party on this. He's not talking about rounding them up and sending them back. He's telling Congress, I'm going to give you a few months, get this thing done, because we have a rule of law in America, not a rule of executive orders. That's what this is really about. You're not going to see 800,000 of them put on a boat and rounded up and sent offshore. But it is, unless we do something, Congress will never act. So this is what's called leadership. And that's I know everybody hates Trump, but what he's doing is leading, and he's telling Congress, get on board, or I'm gonna give you a little time, and then I'm gonna handle things my way.
All right, Lamar.
I would say what we're experiencing is what I would call brinksmanship, and it's unnecessary. And threatening the livelihood and the status of 800,000 Americans was a choice that he made. He has the ability to enforce the laws of the President of the United States. This is him not. You know, and the idea that this is a guy that's been ruling by executive order. So
I would say he's not enforcing it. The law would be that they're illegal and they should be deported. He's saying, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to give Congress time to figure this out.
All right. Here's a note from AJ saying, I give a flip about the Russians. You bet I want to know what President Trump does. Now, Vladimir Putin is one person the president doesn't criticize. He criticizes everybody else, including some great Americans like John McCain, Scott, but I don't know that he's ever had a harsh word to say about Vladimir Putin. What in the world's going on?
I think that he's being a world leader. I mean, you know, I guess he could go put on some Muslim garb and go bow down to some dictators in the Middle East, but we've already had a president like
that. We've never had a president put on Muslim garb and bow down to anybody in the Middle East. Now, come on, you're avoiding the topic. Do you think Vladimir Putin's a good guy?
I don't think he's particularly a good guy. I think he's a tough KGB, ex-KGB operative who happens to run one of the top three most powerful countries in the world.
Well, he interfered with the election. He's been a thorn in the side of the United States. They buzz our boats. They do a lot in our planes. They do many things that are not productive to goodwill with the United States, and yet we have a president who has gone out of his way to praise the leader of Russia.
Well, I think it's similar to what he said during the election. Is it? Do you find it a negative if the president of a foreign country likes our president? I don't, especially when it's Russia that we're talking about. We don't get to pick the leader of Russia.
Right.
We have to deal with them.
Lamar, your thoughts?
I think that that it's likely that Trump owes Russian banks a lot of money. I mean, that's a pretty simple explanation for why he has not said a bad word against Vladimir Putin or Russian leadership. It's pretty clear.
All right, Jennifer in Lafayette. Jennifer, you're on Talk Louisiana with Scott and Lamar. Hi, Jennifer.
Hey, Jim. Thanks for taking my call.
You're on the air.
Hey, thanks for taking my call, Jim. I am no fan of Trump at all. I'm a never Trumper. I left the Republican Party for Trump. But I absolutely 100% have to point out that President Obama absolutely did bow to the King of Saudi Arabia. That's factually evident.
Was he in Muslim garb?
No, he was not in Muslim garb. But let's be honest, if you're going to call out a misstatement or a fact, let's be honest. That was 100% real. Now,
Donald Trump also bowed to the King of Saudi Arabia.
Well, and that was stupid, too. I mean, I don't know what to tell you.
Well,
one doesn't do that. You know, one foreign leader does not bow to another, but or shouldn't. But you know, I don't think that Putin I think Putin is absolutely 100% involved in meddling in U.S. elections. The question is to what degree. But anyway, thanks,
right.
Jim. Y'all take care.
Thank you, Jennifer. Appreciate the call.
Thanks.
And thanks to you, Scott, and to Lamar. And we'll be talking again soon. And we're next with Julian Guthrie with a fascinating story. This is Jim Inkster, and we're joined now by Julian Guthrie, veteran journalist. She's won numerous awards, including the Best of the West Award and Society of Professional Journalists Public Service Award. Spent 20 years at the San Francisco Chronicle. It's also been published by the Wall Street Journal, Huffington Post, and many others. And she is here to talk about a most compelling book, How to Make a Spaceship. Good morning, Julian.
Good morning. Great to be with you.
Well, it's nice to talk about you. And you follow a lot of mavericks, Richard Branson, Paul Allen, Elon Musk. These are fascinating people, aren't they?
They are. And, you know, I am so proud of the story that I got to tell. It's an amazing story of, you know, a group of people with really crazy, very big dreams and trying to figure out how to make those seemingly impossible dreams come true. In this case, it was create a private path to space, which didn't exist. And So, you know, kind of this improbable story in every way of both the flying machines, the people who did it, small teams in the Mojave Desert, and these pilots straight out of the right stuff. And at the heart of it, you have this guy, Peter Diamandis, who, you know, grew up dreaming of working, you know, just everything so he could one day get to space. And how do you make that happen when the only path is through the government? So that's kind of where it starts.
Well, when he was 8 years old, Peter Diamandis witnessed Apollo 11 land on the moon. What happened from that point on?
So, yeah, he was, you know, this wide-eyed boy, transfixed, listening to Walter Cronkite narrate, and he sets out on this adventure story, what becomes an entrepreneurial adventure story. He is determined to get to space. His superheroes are the astronauts. They are the Buzz Aldrins. And he goes to MIT and he goes to Harvard and he launches, you know, these student space clubs, a national student space club called SEDS, S-E-D-S, which exists today. He starts a rocket company while he is a medical student at Harvard. He starts an international space university while he is at Harvard and does all of these things, again, with the singular dream of one day getting to space. And when he realizes, once he's getting out of college, out of medical school with the six-pack of degrees, he realizes he's probably not going to get there through NASA, because even if he becomes an astronaut, his chances of actually flying, other astronauts had told him this, are very slim. So he lands on this idea of an incentive competition. He takes a page from history, realizes Charles Lindbergh flew in 1927 from New York to Paris to win a prize, not as a stunt. And when he lands, he becomes the most famous man on Earth, but he also, you know, jumpstarts the commercial airline industry. And so Peter hears about that and he thinks, wow, and he's out of college and he thinks, what if I could do the same thing for to create a private space industry? So that's where it goes to kind of next. And then from there, you know, it's just one unexpected thing after the other, you know, who is pulled in and what is made and the risks that were taken. And, you know, Peter launches this $10 million prize for the first team that can build and fly a rocket to the start of space twice within 2 weeks. So it really goes off on all of this wild adventure story from there.
The book is How to Make a Spaceship, a New York Times bestseller, now in paperback, from Julian Guthrie. The preface is by Richard Branson, the afterword by Stephen Hawking. A Band of Renegades, An Epic Race, and the Birth of Private Space Flight. Now, this is something that Diamandis concocted, and as you say, he was inspired by Charles Lindbergh. Was he pleased with the result?
So, it's funny because he, you know, he announces the prize in 1996. And again, he's surrounded by, you know, the superheroes of his youth, by Buzz Aldrin. He's got Burt Rutan, the aviation designer, on stage with him, and Eric Lindbergh, Charles's grandson. He announces $10 million prize, and the word goes out across the globe for the first team that can do this without the government's help, you know, send a man machine to space and bring him back safely twice. But he announces this minor detail without the $10 million. He thought it was going to be easy to get the money and difficult to get the teams, and it proves just the opposite. So he then sets out, and he's told no. He seeks the funding for the $10 million. Teams are building, you know, their spaceships in Romania and in the United States, across the country, and in England and in Argentina. And yet Peter still doesn't have the money. So he's knocking on door after door. 150 people tell him no. He doesn't give up. So would he be pleased with the outcome? He is very pleased with the outcome, but it was an extremely arduous journey where, you know, even his closest friends were telling him at many times to give up, you know, that this is not going to happen, that there's a reason why only the world's three largest governments had done before. So it's that journey, and it's these people that he motivated to become a part of this and who had a shared dream. Amazing adventure story and entrepreneurial story, really, for anybody who is trying to do something really, really challenging. And this is kind of a roadmap for how to make your own so-called moonshot a reality.
This deadline of December 31st, 2004 was extremely significant, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. And, you know, finally Peter, you know, is able to cobble together the money in the craziest ways, really some fun things in there. And then also through a benefactor who happens to be a woman. I loved it that a woman came in at the end and helped save the day. But, you know, there was a deadline. So he had this money, but the money, the $10 million that he has worked for so many years to get, and this dream that he's had since he was a little boy, you know, is about to play out, but it has to happen by the end of 2004. And actually 13 years ago this month, the first XPRIZE flight by Spaceship One takes place in the Mojave Desert. This team of fewer than 30 people led by this maverick, Burt Rutan, these real outliers, really, you know, try to make history. And tens of thousands of people, I don't know if you followed this at the time, but tens of thousands of people flocked to the Mojave Desert to witness what they hope will be, you know, history, with the first XPRIZE flight on September 28th, 2004, and anomalies, difficulties, you know, with every flight, and people watching this live, including the wives of the, you know, of the test pilots, and as the test pilots were white-knuckling it to the start of space, and then the second flight for the XPRIZE October 4, 2004. So all of this is playing out, you know, with this deadline when the money would run out. There was no way he was going to get a second chance. So a lot of drama, a lot of tension, and everything invested personally.
Well, today, Spaceship One is hanging in the Smithsonian's Air and Space Museum, flanked by the Apollo 11 capsule, and Charles Lindbergh's playing the Spirit of St. Louis. Julian, where do you think this is going from here?
I think that, you know, the story that I got to tell, How to Make a Spaceship, is really a great backstory to the exciting commercial space industry of today, where you have, you know, I was able to interview Elon Musk, and when he was just starting to think about getting into space, and now, of course, he has Tesla and SpaceX is doing extraordinary work with its rockets and its launches and its private-public partnership, really, with NASA, and, you know, hopes to carry astronauts up to the International Space Station in the next year or two. Jeff Bezos, the founder of Amazon, has his own space company, Blue Origin. He's also in the book. And, of course, Richard Branson, who bought the technology from Spaceship One and is using it for Spaceship Two to take paying passengers to space. That is all happening. And, you know, whether and when we get back to the moon, there's a $30 million Google Lunar XPRIZE where private teams, this was Peter's idea as well, are competing to get to the moon. That's happening right now with launch dates by the end of the year or early next year. Elon is planning to get to Mars by 2024, which may be ambitious. And all of these things are happening that were never, you know, that would have seemed impossible before, and that I think are many of these entrepreneurs that I just referenced were directly involved with Peter and the XPRIZE are very inspired by it.
What do you think Peter Diamandis's legacy will be?
You know, he's founded something like 18 companies or co-founded. He has an asteroid mining company, which is really impressive in Seattle. It's called Planetary Resources. He helps run a Human Longevity Inc. in San Diego to extend the human lifespan. And of course, his baby is the XPRIZE, using incentive competitions to solve the world's biggest problems. I think he'll probably be remembered for this story that I was able to tell about this boy who grows up dreaming of space and helps launch, you know, not just make history, but launch an industry. And he's helping me. We're launching, as part of the paperback, a global competition or campaign where people can go to Facebook and go search How to Make a Spaceship book, and you can upload your own moonshots, your own dreams, and win a copy of the book signed by Richard Branson and Peter Diamandis and others. So we're hoping to keep this sort of moonshot thinking, these big dreams alive, and inviting your listeners and you to share your moonshots, your big dreams.
How to Make a Spaceship from Julian Guthrie. The Washington Post says it reads like a thriller. The story sounds incredible, as if torn from the pages of science fiction. It's been a pleasure, and thanks for sharing your story and that of Peter Diamandis. Thank you, Julian.
Thank you for the great interview.
And we'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place. For Ali Baltazar, I'm Jim Inkster. Stay tuned.